Let's get to know the artist behind the epic melodies, songs, and beats. Celebrating the best new music from around the world. This is the A State of Trance Podcast.
Hey, what's up? My name is Ruben Ronde for once again a new podcast for you to listen to. Today we're joined in the studio by none other than John O'Cannon. How are you doing?
Hello, Ruben. I'm good.
It's always nice to see you. First time in the studio, actually, which is kind of a criminal, thing because you've been involved with the State of Trance from the very, very first beginning.
Yeah, yeah.
And you haven't been in the studio yet.
No, my life got very busy there between DJing, family, getting married, having kids, and I was spending as much time with my kids, to be honest with you, that I could. I committed a lot of my life to my family, and between DJing and making music, I just found it hard to make extra time. But I'm glad to be here today, and thanks for having me.
So instead of just being the artist, John O'Cannon, you're also now family man, John O'Cannon, and a little bit of artist, John O'Cannon.
Yeah, that's, you know, my happiness is my family and my wife. That's my safe place, and being on the road is my passion. You know, my trance is my something that I've been wanting to do since I was 18 years of age. So to be still doing it is a true pleasure and honor.
Okay, let's dive back into the days when you were 18 years old. How did John O'Cannon fall in love with music?
My sister actually used to go to Ibiza when she was a little bit older than me.
Yeah.
And she would bring back CDs like Ministry of Sound, the triple CDs mixed by Pete Tong and Boy George, Judge Jules. And I would get them secondhand, basically. You know, I was getting the cast off CDs that she was finished.
So she would get a new one and then you would get the old one.
Yeah, exactly. And I used to then kind of just explore them, and I didn't even really know what dance music was. I just knew that I liked this music. Mm-hmm. And then around the Chemical Brothers, Faithless became in the pop charts. I was also going on typical sunshine summer holidays with my friends where in Greece, I believe, years and years ago, I went for a drunk holiday with your friends, you know.
And, just a bender, non-stop.
Yeah. And I seen Johan Giel in
Gersonis or something
in Greece,
like that.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and I was like, this is bloody great, you know, I want more of this. So when I came back then to Ireland, I started going clubbing in Dublin. Mm-hmm. With Brian Kearney and Neil Scarborough and Rob Murphy, my manager. And we went to places like the Temple Theatre where we seen Mauro Picotto, Judge Jules, Paul van Dyk, Armin, Ferry, and from there, the interest kind of turned into an obsession. And I was also, like most nerds my age, very into computers. So yeah. I started going like, this guy actually could be interesting to try and learn how they make these songs, because I had a very curious mind when it came to the technological side of things. So,
like a guy, you want to find out how these tunes are actually made.
Yeah, so yeah. I started off with the basic free software you get with a magazine, you know, EJ and stuff. And
Techno EJ.
Yeah, I know.
I remember that one.
Yeah, so I was exploring those and learning, you know, quarter, sixteenths, eighths, like the grids, you know. And my uncle Andrew, is a professional musician who conducts orchestras and is highly trained in piano and all kinds of other instruments.
Yeah.
And he has a full-time studio, not too dissimilar to this, out his back garden, where he produces regular country acts and rock and roll.
Okay.
And he then introduced me to Cubase. So then I was able to, the things got more complicated and I was able to create a decent trance.
Yeah, because the software that you started out with, like the EJ kind of things, was basically just little blocks of samples. They look more like a computer game.
Yeah, exactly.
Stuff like that. And you would stack things on top of it. And then at a certain point, okay, I've used all the samples. Now what are we going to do?
And then, you know, it opens up a whole new door of creativity and possibilities with Cubase and instruments. And, things just kind of snowballed from there. And very quickly, I was making tracks that DJs were playing, like Matt Hardwick, Judge Jules, Hemstock and Jennings. Armin was playing some of my early tracks. And and then from there, I eventually got signed to Discover Records in the UK and Armada, State of Trance.
So it went really fast, to be honest, because you were clubbing. You mentioned it, Johan Giel, Armin. So there was already in early 2000s, 2002, 2003 maybe, that you started out making music?
Yeah, probably a little bit earlier than that in my kind of part-time college days. I was doing a four-year degree in software engineering.
Okay.
And during that time, I was trying to make music, you know, in between exams and pretending to study. So
you started out as a producer rather than a DJ?
Yeah, I had decks in my bedroom at home in my parents' house, and I didn't really know the ins and outs of DJing. It was just pure experimentation.
Yeah.
But yeah, production was my first kind of a deep dive into music before DJing. Yeah.
Because I spoke with a lot of guys that grew up in the same age as you did, and most of the times it was the other way around. Like people discover, they started making, started DJing. And then the next step in a DJ career would be making music to get more shows. For you, it was pretty much the other way around then.
In the group of friends that I had back then, my friends actually had the decks. So if there was a party...
Like Brian New or Rob.
Somebody else always had the decks. So I would go there and practice on somebody else's decks. I never had them in my house because I had a small bedroom and there's no way my parents would.
There was a computer already, and the computer was the size of a truck right now. So,
you know, you got the PC, so you're not getting the decks. You know, that's the way it was. Pick your device. So I went for the PC, and when there was a friend's house party, I would be the one going through all the records, playing the tracks and learning kind of both sides.
Yeah. And then let's jump in time a little bit, because Armada started in 2003, this year celebrating 20 years. And the first introduction that Armada had to you was on the State of Translate was already in 2004. Yeah. So very much in the beginning. Do you still remember the moment that you signed the first EP, the Manix tracks to State of Trance?
Yeah, I made the track, and the first people that were playing it was Ignelli and Elson.
Yeah.
And they really liked it, and I was very kind of happy and surprised that it was going as well as it was. And not too long after that, I sent it to Armin, who played it. And then I got the contact from Armada saying, would I be available to sign it? And at the time, I had a contract with Discovers, which didn't allow my name to be John O'Callaghan on two different levels.
Because the name John O'Callaghan was signed exclusively to Discover.
At that time. So this is where Manix came from, which is my middle name, which is my grandfather's name.
Uh-huh.
And then I started signing more tracks to Armada, and eventually the Discover contract expired.
Yeah.
And then I could release as John O'Callaghan on Armada as well.
And in the meantime, you on Discover, you also released still one of the biggest tunes that you released up to date with your childhood friend, Brian Kearney.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Do you still remember putting that tune together? Because you grew up together, you started clubbing together, and then you had a studio moment together, and then suddenly it was like, boom, he's there.
Yeah, me and Brian had a very similar trajectory in our lives. Both of us love music, but didn't know exactly how to make it.
Yeah.
So we were both very hungry to discover all of the possibilities that were out there. And back then, you know, you did have to actually read magazines.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure it was YouTube around then. Maybe.
No.
You couldn't go on the internet and type how to make trance. You had to learn.
How to make this lead. No, there was no YouTube.
So there was a massive learning curve there. And me and Brian were discovering things at the same time and helping each other out. And like, did you hear this? What about this? You know, and you know, sending each other like 30-second samples of something that took us a week to make.
Yeah.
And Exactly was made in my studio in my parents' old house, and me and Brian were there drinking beers for the weekend, kind of a bed and breakfast vibe that my mother would provide, and like stayed in my house with my parents, and it would probably take 3 days, maybe, you know, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then Brian was back in work on Monday, I believe. He was an electrician at the time.
Yeah.
So you would do Friday, Saturday, Sunday in the studio, a few beers, absolute, just putting all your time into making this track until it was done. And we knew it was good. We weren't like, oh, this is a classic. You never feel that when you make something. You just hope that the person you're sending it to likes it. And at the time, that person was John Askew.
Yeah.
And we sent it to John, and immediately he loved it and signed it to Discover, and it just grew by itself.
It's still a monumental. I don't really understand why there's no reworks or anything at the moment right now. Is it something that you're doing yourself in the future?
There's actually a couple of remixes coming out very soon from Ralphie B and a techno DJ called Sam Wolf.
Okay.
But I think it's a difficult track to remix because it is all about the melody.
And you can't really beat the original still.
The melody only kind of works one way, which is kind of uplifting and powerful.
Yeah.
And when you slow it down, it doesn't really have the same effect. But, you know, we're glad to have it under our belt and we still enjoy playing it.
Absolutely. And then 2007, you closed off your discovery period with the album Something to Live For. That's when you started a new chapter. And I still remember this very well because I just started out at Armada. Also, A&R together with Sander.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that you could say it as the never fade away period. Yeah. Like the albums will never fade away. When you kind of switched from the uplifting instrumental stuff to literally songwriting,
yeah,
basically. Do you still remember the mindset that you had back then that you decided to make a little bit of more of a switch into the songwriting parts?
That was kind of an organic development because when you are still learning how to produce, you're not going straight into vocals because that's like a kind of a forbidden door that you haven't stepped through yet because you're still learning
the next chapter.
How to make trance. So when I eventually began then working with vocals, I could only do that in Cubase because there was a lot more processing and you know, technical side of things to making vocals sound good in trance. So as I became more confident as a producer, I could then expand into vocals and try to make tracks which I wasn't, you know, technically able to make before. So when I was making that album for Armada, that was a kind of a natural progression of, okay, I know how to make uplifting, now I'm going to try to make vocals. And they were the tracks that were kind of becoming more successful in the market at the time. Vocal trance was massive.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kind of pinnacle of having you know, a successful career right then was you needed a vocal trance hit, and that was always the goal, like, you know, to hopefully have that one day. And I made a bunch of okay tracks and some decent ones and some good ones, you know, and the good ones are still around today.
I would say I actually sometimes still listen to that album because, you know, I have very much a personal connection to it as well, because I remember getting all these tracks signed, like Find Yourself, getting the first demos in. I didn't see Find Yourself coming, for example.
Yeah.
Like the original version. Of course, then the remixes became really big afterwards also. But such a different side of you that you don't really see anymore right now.
Yeah, I was at the time, you know, heavily influenced by Gabriel and Dresden.
Yeah.
They were making pretty much the, you know, the top tier of dance music and vocals, you know, Tracking Treasure Down, you know, you can name 20 more As the Rush Comes.
Yeah.
And so they were heroes of mine, they still are. But, you know, instrumentally and like beat wise, I was listening to a lot of their stuff. And once again, I was trying to expand my production knowledge and say, okay, let's use a softer kick. Let's use
a guitar,
a rock snare. Yeah. Let's use a loop that's not a basic trance loop. So I was kind of fulfilling my own kind of thirst for different production techniques and kind of organically Find Yourself then came from that journey. You know, I was in touch with Sarah just on email and she sent me a guitar demo, I think recorded on her phone. And I was like, yeah, I know that's going to be massive. Let's get to work on it. So I combined my interest in the Gabriel and Dresden sound instead of just going for an obvious uplifting trancer, which I knew would work too.
Yeah.
I was probably just experimenting to satisfy my own kind of creative desire, I suppose. And that's where the original mix of Find Yourself came from. And thanks to Nick and Bossy for making a remix, which turned it into the anthem.
That was kind of a 10 out of 10 remix.
Like first nailed it, just unbelievable remix still to this day. So thanks Nick and Bossy for that one.
That was beautiful. I still also remember hearing that remix for the first time together with Sander here in the office. I was like, holy shit, what is this?
I know.
Unbelievable. Actually, I jumped in time a little bit too far because that was the album Never Fade Away, of course. But before that, I have to show you this one.
Yeah.
Big Sky.
Yeah.
Tune of the Year in 2007. That was also, I guess, a very monumental part in your career as well.
Yeah, massive. That came through my friendship with Agnelli and Nelson. I was kind of going to trance college. I was going around to different producers that were like teaching me things.
Yeah.
You know, I was staying in Chris Agnelli's house for weekends and he was kind enough to teach me in his studio, like a lot of the fundamentals of trance that he had passed on to me.
And they have a lot of courses actually right now.
Yeah,
they're doing fantastic. Right?
Sonic Academy.
Sonic Academy, yeah. Also the plugin Anna is amazing.
Yeah,
use it a lot.
If anybody's looking to learn trance, go to Sonic Academy.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I was staying in Chris's house for a few days at a time, and they had Holding On to Nothing.
Yeah.
And I was sitting there with him one day, and I said, "What do you think there is any chance whatsoever that maybe Audrey and me could make a track?" And he said, "Well, I'll ask her, but you have to go and make a pretty good instrumental for that to happen."
No pressure.
So I said, "Okay, no problem. Give me 2 weeks."
Yeah.
And then 6 months later, I came back with the original mix of Big Sky without the vocals, which once again was 130 BPM, different than my other stuff too, which, you know, a lot of people at the time would have said, "Why 130? And that was, once again, I was just trying to do something that I hadn't already done.
And people were saying, "This is not trance." You know,
40 times already. So the Schultz sound at that time was massive. The Cold Harbor, kind of deeper stuff.
The Reese basses.
Yeah. So that's what that was. You know, so I was kind of ticking all these boxes of sounds that I liked and was trying to learn, I suppose, so that I was kind of increasing my own production knowledge all the time by trying to kind of make these sounds. And, you know, the Chris then sent the track to Audrey. And then one day in my parents' house, I got a CD in the post with my name on it. I didn't know what this was like. And I opened it and it was just like a old CDR with the white label on it. And it just said Big Sky Vocals. I was like, okay.
That's it.
The track wasn't called that then. It was just a demo.
Yeah.
So, you know, Audrey took it from just a track to what Big Sky is, you know. And I literally opened the project and like dragged and dropped her vocals onto it. Yeah. And I was just, okay, file export done.
Done straight away.
It was no more takes, not even version 2. That was version 1 was what she sent. And
Do you still have the disc somewhere?
I do. It's nice. At home. It's at home. And then the Big Sky original was signed to Armada. And then Chris, I said, "I need that Holding On to Nothing kind of vibe remix. Can you do it?" And Chris and Robbie, you know, thankfully said yes. And they created a remix, which Armin played a lot and eventually became Tune of the Year.
Also a 10 out of 10 remix.
Oh, yeah, man. Perfect.
You always had a good hunch to ask for remixes. Man. Oh, that's amazing, man. I have fond memories about that. And I can't believe that it's already in 2007. That's so long ago.
I know, man. Jesus.
In the meantime, you also released your album Unfold 2011 later on. And then not really far from there, you started your own label, Subculture.
Yeah, that was a kind of a natural progression again in the growth of my career, because not every track that I was making was probably suitable for a State of Trance or Armada at the time. So it was suggested that I can make my own label to house these.
Create your own identity as well.
I was making a lot of tracks at the time, and not all of them probably would have fit into the schedule. So that's how the label came about, and it was underneath Armada at the time. And I then started building the catalog, and then began working with my own group of artists who were regulars on the label, and things grew from there into what it is today.
You must be extremely proud with the way that everything grew to where it is right now. Because a few weeks ago you had a festival in Melbourne, Australia, with 8,000 people sold out. Starting from a little label in Ireland somewhere to where it is right now.
I know, it really is. Sometimes you do have to step back and look at what's happened. You have to take yourself out of a bubble to see, you know, to be flying to the other side of the world with 8 or 10 mates of mine, basically, other trance DJs who I play with all the time, to be playing to 8,000 people in Australia in a state-of-the-art production and all of the things that I used to I used to go to Gatecrasher in the NEC, and I seen Armin playing Holding On to Nothing, and that was a life-changing moment. I was like, Jesus, wow, this is heavenly, you know, this is what I want to do. And to go from standing on the dance floor to being the other side of the decks to that many people, playing uplifting trance. You know, that's the dream, you know. So thank God it happened, and thank you to everybody who made it happen.
But talking about made it happen, what does it feel like to actually grow up with the people that are managing you right now, to grow up as a group of friends going from a rave? I've seen the pictures of Brian with the blonde hair on the dance floor together with you. What is it like to grow up together as a group of friends and to become successful? All of you guys are successful right now.
Well, I think that's the key, that we remain friends, and it's a group, it's teamwork. You know, if one of us was just pushing to be top of the pile all the time, I don't think it would have worked. Like we helped each other. You know, I have ideas, Brian has ideas. My manager, Rob, has been my friend since I'm 15 years old.
Great guy.
Used to sit beside him in school and give him mixtapes, and he would listen to
like,
them.
Like, oh, another mixtape.
And tell me it's good. I don't know that he even listened. But, you know, we were going to gigs together and parties, and it was, everybody kind of had their own role in the unit that kept it going to the point where it began working as a DJ production management kind of, you know, everybody has their own strengths, you know, and we all still work together closely to this day. And Brian was just in my studio 3 days ago. We were working on new Key 4050 material, and I was at Luminosity last night with Rob. You know, he was there backstage making sure everything went well. So we're a close-knit unit, and now we're working together with Craig, Factor B, Cold Blue, and you know, to help those guys reach the goals that they want to reach, you know.
How do you make sure that everybody's on the same page? Because, you know, the music industry is a very highly competitive scene. There's a lot of people that rather work against you than with you. How do you make sure that everybody stays on the same page within the family?
I think it's a lot to do with the personality of the people you're working with. Like if somebody does want to be king of the castle, you can find out that quite quickly, and it doesn't always then help the team to reach the goals. Like, so Subculture Melbourne, everybody had a role to play.
Yeah.
You know, we picked the set times according to what the promoter wanted and what we felt would work, and everybody goes and plays and does well, and there's no you can't play this or you can't play that. Everybody, no matter when the doors open, you do your thing.
Yeah.
You can go out there and play exactly what you want to play. And I think, you know, the teamwork extends throughout, like the feeling of teamwork kind of grows when you let people do what they want, and you can't say, no, you got to slow that BPM down, or maybe don't play that peak time stuff right then. It's really about letting people become what they want to be. And I think that organically creates a feeling of teamwork between us, you know, and afterwards we all hang out and have a laugh and have a beer or two. And, you know, it's not just work, like we are actually friends.
Yeah, it helps a lot, I guess. Also, yeah. Touring around the planet just with your friends must be the ultimate dream for everyone, I guess.
Yeah, you know, it is a dream. You know, sometimes it takes a couple of weeks after an event to look at the footage and go,
that was a good time.
Jesus, that was good, you know.
Do you sometimes think that you kind of forget when you're in the moment, that you forget to sometimes just appreciate everything that's happening at a certain moment?
Well, me personally, I do put quite a bit of time into preparing my sets, especially when you're only playing for 1 hour.
Yeah.
It kind of has to be perfect. So I do put a lot of pressure on myself in that moment to make sure I'm pressing the right buttons and not the wrong buttons. Because, you know, there's a lot of people looking, and as much as people might think DJing is easy to a certain extent, performing at a high level and not making any mistakes is very different when there's 8,000 people looking at you.
So, and live streams going on and social medias and whatnot.
And you're trying to finish those tracks during the week to play those tracks, and then you got to go up and make sure that you deliver it correctly. And I'm a little bit of a perfectionist when it comes to mixes and levels and stuff. And I will kick myself in the ass for 6 months if something goes wrong. You know, I do my best to make sure everything goes right. And sometimes when you're up there, it is hard to go, okay, I'm in this moment. Look how amazing this is. I tend to do that afterwards. I
like, so you're too focused on what you're doing now.
You know, when I finish and Brian is on, I will then relax and say, wow, look what's going on. But like when I'm up there, I have to be in the moment, because it's the level of concentration is quite high, as you know.
Yeah. Well, kind of sometimes, especially when you're preparing for such a long time for something as well. Now, there's one thing I need to address as well before we dive into some fan questions that were submitted, because throughout the years, you get it quite some aliases.
Yeah.
I mean, Key 4050, of course, with Brian, Joint Operations Center, you mentioned it on air as well. That was like the more the techno period kind of sound that you were doing. Manex, well, you explained earlier that it was because of the contract that you had exclusivity. But my personal favorite is Henrik Zuberstein.
Yeah.
How come does a guy like yourself that normally is in the 135s, 138s, 140 or even up, end up with an alias like Henrik Zuberstein, which is like progressive, really deep storytelling music?
Well, I suppose it's most artists who are doing a certain style of music for a long time, in order to keep being inspired, you need to listen to other music in order for the ideas to flow. If you're just listening to one thing all the time, I don't think the ideas will be as creative. So
yeah, you're stuck in a loop, basically.
Yeah, you're recreating what's already out there. So I went through a period of years where I was listening to loads of John Digweed, Sasha, Hernan Cattaneo. My favorite DJ for years was Guy J. And just the sounds and the organic kind of beauty in those tracks was really appealing to me. They were melodic. It was, you know, there was trance melodies in there, chords,
yeah,
all the kind of stuff that I like, but just a little bit slower and a little bit softer, which allowed me to listen to more of it. Because, as you know, if you're in this industry for 20 years, your ears do take a bashing.
Sometimes.
And the harder and louder the music, it can get a little bit harsher on your actual ears. So I had to listen to some softer stuff in my downtime in order to let my ears basically heal, because I had some hearing issues in 2018, 2020 that I had to just give them a break from intense music. And listening to people like Guy J, I then, you know, like years ago, thought to myself, maybe I can make this. And
another challenge for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I started then creating a few files that I thought might sound good, and a few of them turned out good, which you liked, and Armin played a couple, and that was another challenge for me. And Hernan Cattaneo was playing my tracks at the time, which was something I never thought would happen.
Like, bucket list.
I know. I was like, my goodness, does he know what I play?
Yeah. Does he know who Henrik Zuberstein is?
So that was a massive satisfaction moment there, and I still love that stuff, and it's one of the most creative genres for me. And it doesn't have this, you know, CO2 fire going off peak time moment that kind of reflects my personality a little bit. Like, I'm not a CO2 fire going off kind of guy. I like the kind of the understated side of the business. And someone like Guy J, who just goes up there, plays for 3 or 5 hours, basically relaxes, has a good time, and listens to some awesome music. There's a side of me that really appreciates that. And Henrik Zuberstein was a combination of Henrik Larsson from Celtic.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah.
And
the Swedish former international. Yeah. Used to play in Rotterdam here also at Feyenoord.
Zuberstein was a combination of an old Seinfeld joke, and one time I was doing a gig in New York, and somebody randomly in the crowd said, "Hey, if you're ever looking for real estate, here's my card." And his name was something Silverstein.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I thought that was a very funny moment. And I still have the card at home. I was like, just if you're ever interested in real estate. So it was a combination of Henrik Larsson and Mr. Silverstein, which became Henrik Zuberstein.
That's brilliant, to be honest.
Yeah.
So recently, you did your very first open to close in Belfast.
Yeah.
Does that mean that you would start out with Henrik Zuberstein because you played 5 hours, something like that? You start out with Henrik Zuberstein and you end with Joint Operations Center?
I started off 120 and finished off like 143 probably. It was a true journey that I put a ton of time into preparing and practicing at home, because it's not something you can just show up and randomly play and think that it's going to go okay. So there was a lot of checking of mixes and chords and transitions, and I did put weeks into it, and I was very nervous doing it. You know, it's a big difference getting up there for 90 minutes and playing tracks that you know like the back of your hand, than playing a 5 hour set and playing a range of music that you never play. So it was very daunting, I would say, but enjoyable.
Yeah, I did a 9 hour set last year. Now, it's the same thing that you just said. You would say preparing for this takes literally weeks.
Yeah.
Going through the music. And also what I did, I just created certain blocks. And sometimes you would skip a track or you wouldn't. And then suddenly you would end up being in the fifth hour already. And you were supposed to be in the sixth or seventh already. And then you're behind. So it's all this planning. It's insane.
I know. I don't always look at my watch when I'm playing, but I did have to on that because I was
at some points that
I'm in hour three and it's hour two. What am I going to do?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's how it feels. Yeah. Well, we're way over time already, but there's so much nice stories, man. But I want to address a few questions from some fans that were submitted through Instagram, starting with O'Farah. Which subgenres do you enjoy playing the most? Not listening to at home, but playing the most? Well, we just addressed that a little bit already, but...
Yeah, I would say a combination of melodic progressive trance and techno. I love techno and I am a percussive kind of a guy. I used to play the drums in a silver band, they call it in Ireland, which is a band with the trumpets and horns and all that kind of stuff. That's what I was musically first introduced to drums. My dad is a drummer, so anything percussive, I really get a kick out of. And I don't always get to play it, but when I do have a kind of a secret kind of a, I'm buzzing inside, you know, to getting to play that because it's not always available.
It's like exciting.
Yeah, it's something different, yeah.
Awesome. I guess this is not really a question, but a compliment. Then Kian says, how does it feel like to be one of the greatest trance producers of all time? Well, you don't have to answer that, but there you go. That's a nice compliment.
Thank you for
saying that. Pabek just wants to know, what do you prefer, DJing or creating your own music? Ooh, that's hard. Potato, you know?
They both definitely have their, you know, being at home on your own with nobody there, with the door closed and exploring your own mind is, you know, I do get a kick out of that and the satisfaction of finishing and creating a track that you know is going to go off at a club that you're playing at. To be honest with you, it is 50-50 because if I was just making the music and not playing it, I'm not sure I would continue as long as I have, you know.
Yeah, because I think I've discussed this in the podcast a few times. You need to have input to create output.
Yeah.
Yeah. So without input from the gigs, you would have a hard time creating music.
Seeing the track work that was 3 days ago in your studio and nobody heard it and now you're playing it to 5,000 people.
Yeah.
And you don't have to let anybody else hear it to say, do you think it's good or not? You know, so that it's a combination of being able to create and being able to share. I think that's the most satisfying for me.
I agree. Amy's Dunn wants to know, what does subculture have in store for us the coming months?
Well, at the moment, I've just finished three new originals. I'm going to be filtering those out over the next 3 to 6 months. I've got a track called Riverside, which is the follow-up to One Special Particle, classic uplifting trance that I hope people will like. I've got a collab with Paul Skelton and Sue McLaren, which is a kind of an
Angelus
style trancer. Yeah. And I also have more collabs coming up. Myself and Brian are working on the follow-up to I Love You.
Ooh.
Which is sounding massive.
No pressure. Absolutely no pressure.
It's sounding good. You know, like, thank God. Once again, the trance gods have been good to us. And, you know, the tune appeared on our doorstep and me and Brian are already very happy and confident. So, like, that's a good sign. For the rest of the year, Maria Healy, Craig Connolly, Lostly, you know, a lot of people who you already know and love. Thank you for listening to Subculture Records.
And another question that's actually... well, kind of intertwined with this one. From Ellie Wheels, do you have any plans to work with Cold Blue again?
We do actually have a collab that's been underway for about a year that is sitting at my studio right now. The melody's great. All I need to do is work on some of the beats. Tobias is about as fussy as I am when it comes to production. Sometimes I make what I am very happy with and I send it to him and he says no.
Yeah.
And vice versa. So it does take a lot for both of us to get that perfect mix of his style and my style.
Version 562B.
That's pretty much what it is. It's on 121C right now.
I know how it feels. Well, thank you so much for answering all these questions. And please don't wait another 10 years to drop by in the studio.
You let me know, Ruben. I'll be back here soon.
That's the deal.
Okay. Thanks, all right, man.
Thank you so much for answering these questions. Thank you for tuning into the State of Trance podcast. And I'll see you next time for a new one. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. Check all previous episodes on YouTube or your favorite podcast portal. A State of Trance Podcast.